To start things off today, I've invited Kyle Manis in the studio. I read about Kyle a couple of weeks ago in a piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about former drug addicts who would go to local hospital emergency rooms when they got a call that somebody had come in who had overdosed and really helped that person overcome their addiction, or at least try to overcome their addiction. And Kyle is here in the studio with me today. Hi, how are you?
Hey, how's it going, Paul? Thanks for having me.
My pleasure having you in here. You were an addict, addicted to what?
What do you got?
Really?
Yeah, it didn't matter to me. Anything that would change the reality that I found too painful to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How long were you taking all sorts of drugs?
About 14 years, 15
wow.
years.
Wow.
Yeah. Like 14 to 28.
Before we talk about what you're doing for other people, may I pry by asking what that did to your life?
Sure. Well, I guess around the age of 12, my parents split up, moved back to St. Louis. We were in Arkansas. I guess that kind of left a void in my life and came to St. Louis. I started getting high with my sister and her friends. Started out just drinking, smoking weed, stuff like that. That quickly progressed into hallucinogens, cocaine. I was arrested when I was 14. First time I went to Clayton Corrections for Youth because I had some acid and some alcohol on me. That didn't do anything. It didn't scare me.
Being arrested didn't scare you?
No, no. And they actually gave my mom a choice. Hey, you can come pick him up or you can leave him here. She's like, I'll just keep him.
Wow.
Yeah. So she was trying to do the right thing, actually. That's what I would recommend, is just, you know, let people have their pain. So
how long were you in?
I was only in for a night.
Okay.
They let me go the next day, got out, really didn't do anything.
So when you say it didn't do anything, there was no opportunity for it to do anything.
Not
because
really.
All you did was spend a night in the lockup.
Yeah. Well, you know, then you got the mandated court things that you got to do, like classes and go to meetings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the problem. I didn't have a problem. It was just getting caught was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So about 5 years later, you know, I was probably progressed into opioids, pills, just mixing that with alcohol, smoking a lot of weed.
So when you say pills, we're talking about Oxy?
Yeah, Oxys, Percocets, Vicodin, Xanax, whatever.
Were you actually doing heroin as well?
Not yet.
Okay.
So I'm like 19, I get another arrest, possession charge, DWI, got like 6 tickets total in that. Spent another overnight in county.
Which had no effect on you?
No effect. Got picked up the next day by my mom, went back home, did a lot of other court-mandated classes, stuff like that, you know. 5 years later, get arrested again, another DWI, another possession charge.
Mm-hmm.
This is after countless minor and possession charges, you know, little slaps on the wrist.
Yeah.
You know, being a white kid from the county, it was pretty easy to get out of stuff, just a slap on the wrist. Again, didn't really do anything to me. I continued to drink and drive and everything like that. And they said, you know, the judge even said, you know, if I see you in here again, it's 90 days, no questions asked. And so I guess that kind of scared me a little bit, but not enough to stop.
Okay, now let's stop the story just here for a second, because this is a lot of years we're talking about.
Yeah.
At what point do you consider yourself an addict as opposed to just a young kid doing stuff for kicks?
I was a full-blown alcoholic before I was legally allowed to drink, for sure. And I knew that. I was in a band for a long time, punk rock band around St. Louis for like 10 years. That kind of fueled the behavior. Even my friends in the band that were also alcoholics would say, man, you know, you're drinking whiskey in the morning, this is crazy. Like, you know, 4 or 5 shots, get the day started, go to work, drink at work, come home. So, you know, when I was probably 19, I was full-blown, full-blown addict.
Full-blown alcoholic.
Full-blown alcoholic, full-blown. I knew that, you know, I had issues.
Yeah.
I knew I had issues, but I wasn't to the point that I was like, I guess I hadn't had enough pain to really stop that behavior yet.
And along the way, you were addicted to each different level of drugs, if you would.
Sure.
Because there's a giant ladder of effect between weed and opioids.
Yeah.
Was it that you were looking for a better high?
Yeah. Yeah. I was always looking for something else because I would become tolerant. You know, so it wouldn't matter how much weed I smoked or how much, you know, alcohol I drank. I would, you know.
Wasn't satisfactory.
I was just getting well, basically, at that point. So I was trying to still get high.
Yeah.
So opioids was the next. appropriate step, I guess.
Okay, so you get to the point where the judge says, if I see you in here again,
right,
I'm going to throw you in the slammer for 90 days.
Yeah. So what do? I get a job real close to home at a bar so I can walk. So I started walking to work because I wasn't going to stop drinking. I met a girl. She became my fiance, and she introduced me to a really good pill hookup. It was her father's girlfriend.
Ooh.
And I kind of turned her into an alcoholic, and she fueled the pills. So it was a match made in heaven.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you marry her?
No. The first time I went to treatment, I mean, it had gotten so bad that I was having, like, seizures and stuff. I didn't drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I was showing signs of cirrhosis and jaundice when I was 28. So my mom and my fiance at the time and my sister were just like, you got to do something. Because by that time, I was drinking so much, I couldn't go to work. And it just got so sloppy that I couldn't do anything.
Did you know how messed up your life was at that point? Or are you just so drunk all the time and high all the time that you have no concept and that's all you know?
Once it came to the point where I couldn't pay the bills and I couldn't function. Because I was drinking just to function.
Mm-hmm.
And I was using drugs just to function. But it got to the point where I had to use so much that I couldn't function.
Mm.
So I knew at that point, I was like, this is it. Like, I got to do something.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to die for sure.
Okay, so what did you choose to do?
Chose to go into an inpatient rehab, CMO Behavioral Health in Farmington. I went there for 2 weeks, got out, had to go live with mom because I couldn't pay the bills.
Could that 2 weeks do anything for you?
Yeah. Yeah, it actually did. It kind of opened my eyes a little bit, and I was, like, really wanting to be clean. But that's all I was doing. I wasn't in recovery or anything like that. I was just trying to stay clean.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do the meetings. I didn't want to do the 12-step thing. You know, I kind of detested that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, you know, the punk rock mentality. I'm not going to conform to any groups, anything like that.
I'll do this myself.
Right, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah.
I'm strong, right? Obviously. So I got a job. I stayed clean for, I think I put together like 60 or 70 days. And just wasn't really doing anything besides not doing the drugs.
Mm-hmm. And then your girlfriend bought you a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, you remember from the article. Yeah, she did. She brought a bottle of whiskey over to my mom's house, and that was it.
Right back into the cycle.
Right back in. It was like I never stopped. It was mm-hmm. crazy. I couldn't believe it. I thought I could maybe just do it once, you know, but I knew at that point, I was like, wow, I really can't control this. But attempting to control it was what kept me out there for so long.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to control it so bad.
Yeah.
You know, and I could not admit that I was powerless over something like that.
Yeah.
So
as you went along after that, you've tried recovery. It mm-hmm. hasn't worked because somebody kind of reintroduced you to a substance.
Right. But I allowed for that to happen. I mean, I definitely don't blame anyone but myself.
But then you got to another point where you got off it again.
I did.
And that didn't stick either.
Right. My mom was like, you know, she knew that something was going on again. You know, I tried to be slick, but I wasn't.
Yeah.
She was like, you got to be in some kind of program if you're going to be in this house. I was like, okay. So I started doing like an outpatient in West County. I actually did pretty good for a while. And then I got introduced to K2.
What's that?
K2 is like a synthetic cannabinoid,
mm-hmm.
But it's nothing like cannabis. The effects are more like PCP.
Mm-hmm.
And if you smoke it long enough, you kind of start catching a nod like you would be doing heroin.
Wow.
And it's really hard to get off of. It's very addicting. I would compare it to crack or cocaine.
Mm-hmm. That's pill or smoke?
Smoke. Yeah. And it's sold as like some kind of aromatherapy incense. That stuff really brought me down to my knees. So I started doing that. I got a job at FedEx. Because I started doing that, but I stopped. And I was still an outpatient. And I think I put together like another 60 days clean. Still not working a program of recovery, just trying to stay clean.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a job at FedEx driving a truck. And I was like, wow, this is a really good job. And then one day, I was just coming home. I don't know why. I remember fighting it. Like, don't do it. Don't do it. And I pulled into the gas station. I got four little, you know, those little one-shot bottles of vodka,
mm-hmm.
off and running again.
Right back into the cycle.
Mm-hmm. And then about 2 weeks later, I think after that, I just woke up. I had passed out in my FedEx truck with a bottle in a hand, one hand and a pipe in the other, smoking that K2. So, you know, I got fired.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued to act like I was going to work in the morning. You know, I put on my uniform and everything like that. And my mom was still like, she knew something was going on. She came home one day. I was passed out in the living room. She's like, you know, like I said, you can't use here. So I continued to use. And I passed out again. She called me again. She was like, you gotta go. It was the best thing she ever did for me.
So at that point, you started living in your car.
I started living in my car. It was winter, 2013. It was miserable. Mm-hmm. I was just waking up in my car every day in this parking lot at these apartments, Upper Greenmar in Fenton, where my buddy Russ lived. I was using with him. We were smoking K2 and drinking together and everything like that. And so I had the car. He had the place to stay. And that's all addicts do is use each other. So I got a way to use you. You got a way to use me. So this is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So every day we would drive to North County and he would cop dope. He'd be doing heroin. He was shooting it. And I'd never done heroin before. Never even been around it. But, you know, I was so drunk and I was so miserable at this point. I was going to do anything. So he introduced it to me. I started snorting it. Next thing I know, I'm...
Now you're addicted to heroin.
Yeah. I'm just waking up on the floor not knowing what happened because I was doing it drunk. You know, you mix those opioids and alcohol like that, it's going to kill you.
So when did you get clean? Can you? By the way, you've been off it for a while.
Yeah, May 12th, 2014 is my clean date. Yeah.
Addicts always know the date.
Yeah, I got tattooed into me.
Yep. I stopped drinking October 11th, 1993.
No kidding. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Everybody knows the date.
That's right. If you don't know the date... You probably haven't had your last day yet.
Yep. So now your job is to go help other addicts.
Yeah.
Somebody overdoses in any of the many hospitals in this area.
Yeah, we got a lot of hospitals on board now. We got Barnes, SLU, Christian Northeast, Christian Northwest, DePaul, SSM, Mercy St. Louis, Mercy Jefferson, St. Anthony's, Highland Behavioral Health.
So one of these hospitals has somebody come into the ER. They've overdosed. Most likely on an opioid nowadays.
Right.
And you get a call.
Mm-hmm.
And you go in there, and what do?
So basically, like a social worker or a nurse or anyone, they screen the potential client. And if they agree to talk to someone about getting help, then we'll come out. And, you know, I just share my experience. I say, man, I'm an addict. I'm not, you know, I kind of know what you're going through. I've been probably exactly where you are right now.
Or worse. Yeah.
So they're really receptive to that when they know it's another addict coming to talk to them.
I'm sure. Because if it were some, nothing against academics, but if it were some academic who had never used, who was trying to talk them out of this lifestyle that they were used to, because that person can't relate, nothing gets done. You, having been there, you can relate to them.
And counselors and therapists can help these people, but they're not receptive to it. They're more receptive to talking to someone that's been there.
Mm.
I don't know why, but it's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I just say, you know, what are you doing here? You know, and they'll say, well, I overdose or whatever. And I was like, well, you want to get help? They say, yeah, almost always because, you know, they've been vetted at that point. They have to agree for us to come out there.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I set an appointment up to come see us the next morning, sometimes the same day. And the doctors write them a prescription most of the time for buprenorphine. And we start medically assisted treatment induction at the ER right then.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, let me just go back a second. When they say they want help, how many of them are saying that because that's what they've been saying over and over and over again every time they got picked up for whatever?
That's a good question. I can't judge someone's willingness to get clean. I can just judge what they do. If they say they want help, I'm going to try to help them no matter if they show up or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to continue to try to help them if they keep reaching out.
Okay. So you get them on this medically assisted program.
Mm-hmm.
And before they even get to that point, I know I'm jumping around here, but I got to go back one step before they got to the ER.
Mm-hmm.
What are the chances that that person had Narcan applied to them by an EMT?
Pretty good chance.
It works?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Narcan saves a lot of lives.
Okay.
We distribute Narcan in this program also. We send it home.
You know there's some controversy about that, which is that if people have... the knowledge that there's this thing that will stop their overdose, then they're more likely to be more careless.
You know, the studies have shown that it doesn't affect people. It does not affect people's amount of use. It doesn't because no one intends on overdosing.
Right.
You know, unless they want to kill themselves.
Yeah. That argument didn't carry a lot of water with me.
No.
Because I think either you're already doing this sort of stuff,
right,
or you're not. It's right. Not like somebody says, well, you know what? Now that there's a drug that could save me, I'm going to start taking pills and heroin.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm going to start doing a lot more and see, you know, how far I can push the envelope. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't work that way.
Okay.
This is just damage control. You know, we're trying to save people's lives so they can recover, because people do recover, but you can't if you're dead.
Yeah.
So people, I mean, I would suggest reading some studies, educating yourself, and getting over your moral dilemma, because you might have someone in your family one day that's an addict, and you're not going to want them to die.
Right.
You know, so it's really just kind of a heartless stance, in my opinion, to say, well, that's just going to give them another reason.
Yeah.
It doesn't give them another reason.
I don't buy it at all.
Good.
When you're working with these people, are you also working with their families?
Yeah. I mean, it's a family disease. So, I mean, they're offered family counseling, stuff like that. Sometimes their family's there. A lot of the times they're not. They're not there in the ER. So we try to provide overdose education, and we distribute naloxone or Narcan to the family. And we, you know, if the family is still in the addict's life, then yeah, we'll help them out too.
What kind of success rate are you having?
We've had some incredible numbers. We just ran the numbers yesterday, and let's see here. I got them right here. At referral, the average number of patient ER visits in the past 3 months is 1.09. The average number of ER visits at the three-month follow-up is 0.12, yielding an 89% decrease in emergency room visits.
Wow.
In the eastern region.
Wow.
So it's really saving the state a lot of money and saving a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, making things easier for cops.
Absolutely.
Because they've got to deal with this stuff.
Yes.
And EMTs.
Yeah, cops have the Narcan a lot. A lot of the times, like, because we take the information, like, was Narcan administered, by whom?
Yeah.
A lot of the times it's by the police.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or EMS or family. So we've handed out a lot of Narcan. Let's see.
How many different addicts are you working with at any one time, you personally?
Usually 30 to 40.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say 5 or 6, 30 or 40.
Yeah. We've engaged like almost 500 since December of last year.
Wow.
When it started.
Mm-hmm.
The pilot project was, we were supposed to help 100 people, and we just blew that away, of course. And if you think about it, that's really a small percentage of the actual overdose, because not only do they have to make it to the hospital, survive the overdose, they have to be willing to come talk to
right,
us.
Right, right.
So that's 455 in a year. That's a small percentage.
Yeah.
And
we've lost hundreds of people.
Yeah.
Who didn't get that far.
Yeah, I believe opioid overdose is the number one killer for people under the age of 35 in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So you're literally saving lives.
I would like to hope so.
Yeah.
I think so. I try to. I'm just a messenger.
Well, because you know the story of somebody who has had to go and get whatever the first step was or the second step was, you know that that's not the last step for a lot of people. From your own experience, you've had multiple steps to get to where you are now.
Right. And there have been a few occasions where I've gone to the ER, and it's a person that I've outreached before.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, man, don't beat yourself up over this, you know, because they're obviously miserable. They're not out there having fun.
Mm-hmm.
People think that people that are doing hardcore drugs are having fun. It's not fun. Okay, it's something that you have to do. It's taken, you know, your brain over, and it says you have to have this or you're going to die. Mm-hmm. So you're going to do anything to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And your disease expresses itself in ways that are antisocial and socially unacceptable, so people don't want to have anything to do with you.
I want to ask how they afford it, but I'm guessing that they're not using their own money.
I'm guessing. Some people actually have jobs, but a lot of time, you know, you're off King's Highway flying a sign, you know, begging for money, or, you know, strong-arming people.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, you know, I would do anything. I'd break into houses. I would, you know, stealing was definitely a part of my story.
Mm-hmm.
I was grimy. I was doing bad things.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people that are the best people I know today have done some really bad things, but have atoned for that, have made amends for that, and continue to.
If someone listening to us right now has a member of their family who's going through this, let's say they're in the same situation your mother was.
Mm-hmm.
You got a kid in their teens, 20s, 30s, whatever. What should they do?
Cut them off unless they want help.
Cut them off from all support.
That's right.
You mean don't even let them have a place to live?
That's right. That's what I would do.
If you force them into the streets, what's going
to
happen?
They're going to have a lot of pain, and they might be forced to make a decision at that point. Mm-hmm. If you give them a place to use, they're going to use. They're going to use your resources. They're going to drive you crazy. You will physically become sick, as my mother did. My mother used to tell me that she slept better knowing that I was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
If my mother wouldn't have kicked me out, I would still be there using, or I'd be dead. If you baby an addict, you will bury them. I promise you. So it's tough love.
What can they do to avoid having to make this decision in the emergency room to save their kid before he or she overdoses? Is there a program they can get him into? Is there something that you're involved in that can be a help to them?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm part of, 12-step programs are free. I'm part of a 12-step program. Besides that, I mean, if they have any experience with overdosing in the past, I mean, don't wait till they overdose again. Bring them to the hospital. Tell them that you've heard of Epic Outreach, and we'll come and talk, and we'll hook them into treatment.
Epic Outreach.
That's right.
You're doing a really good thing. In the past, you've done a lot of really bad things.
Yeah.
But now you're turning your life around, and you're turning around the lives of a lot of people, and I congratulate you on that.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Kyle Manis here on the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS.